Welcome to Preaching Podcasts. This is a series of podcasts for those who proclaim publicly. It's a weekly podcast from the Stevenson School for Ministry in the Diocese of Central Pennsylvania, where we take a look at the lectionary from diverse and unique perspectives to help prepare church teachers, proclaimers, preachers, leaders for Sunday worship. I'm your host, Deirdre Good, and with me today is Althea Spencer-Miller and Josh Davis. Hello. Hello, you two.
Hello, Deirdre. Hello, Josh.
Hello, Deirdre. Hello, Althea.
Wonderful to be with you today. We're looking at the readings for the Sunday closest to June 29th, and I have in mind a theme that I'm going to mention. The readings are pretty... Well, the Genesis 22 reading is pretty provocative. The sacrifice or binding of Isaac. We'll certainly talk about that. Track 1 has Psalm 13. Track 2 has Psalm 89. Psalm 13 is really a psalm of anguish. And there are all sorts of conditions under which we might want to utter that. But if I could switch, for reasons that will become clear, to Psalm 89, I want to bring out a theme that seems to be mentioned in the first two verses of Psalm 89, but I'm puzzled by the translation here. So in the text that you and I, all three of us, are looking at, I've got a translation that opens with an address to God, Psalm 89, verse 1, "Your love, O Lord, forever will I sing. From age to age, my mouth will proclaim your faithfulness." Verse 2, "For I am persuaded that your love is established forever. You have set your faithfulness firmly in the heavens." Now, I'm really puzzled by that translation because it isn't even the NRSV text. So Psalm 89 in my version of the NRSV has verse 1 and 2, "Instead of love, steadfast love." A much better, more familiar translation of chesed, the Hebrew word for loving kindness, steadfast loving kindness, hence the term steadfast in verse 1 and 2. So I can't really understand where that translation of love, which puts us into a completely different universe, has come from in the lectionary page. So if I take a theme for some of these readings as the faithfulness or chesed of God, I think we can do quite a lot with that. Matthew 10, the gospel, 40 to 42, very, very short gospel. What would be a motivating factor to welcome anyone in someone's name, to extend to someone, as the chapter says, even a cup of cold water to one of these little ones in the name of a disciple? What would motivate someone to do that kind of thing for anyone? I remember years ago, permit me this digression, years ago I was taking a walking holiday. A lot cheaper to go walking, especially if one is young enough not to be able to drive yet. Anyway, there we were in Yorkshire. We were climbing hills. I was with my cousin, who's about my age, and two friends of ours. And we climbed the hill to the rectory of the Bronte family at Haworth in Yorkshire. And it was quite a hill. I mean, we were young and energetic and so on. But as we got to the top of the hill, it was a hot day, sort of pre-global warming in the UK, but nevertheless very hot. A total stranger came out of the house at the top of the hill with a tray full of four glasses of water. Why? What motivates somebody to do that? You look at the conditions or circumstances, and in response to those conditions or circumstances of need, you do something. So this chesed, this idea of God's chesed, which sets in motion a chain of goodwill, is also human chesed. Now, it has, of course, some other connotations and so on. We could talk about that. But I've been thinking about that quite a lot recently, and I thought I'd mention it in regard to Psalm 89. So can I just start us off there and see if there are other ideas you both have, or you want to pick up something else?
I'm good to work with that idea. I found it a little challenging to pick up a consistent theme this time. So I'm glad you're pointing us to the idea of Hesed and the spillover into human kindness. And I'm thinking of with just bringing into the conversation, thinking with Matthew 10, 40 to 42, which is a big piece where the human Hesed-like action comes in.
Mm-hmm.
The way it, whether or not it's reasonable to think about those verses also as hospitality markers, not markers that signal people's will to do to be hospitable, but hospitality in varying degrees as a mark of receiving the kingdom message of these messengers, of willingness to have some level of identification with the work of Jesus, but also that it is a guarantee of a kind of ultimate hesed, that God's reward will be there for you, for those people who do even the least from a cup of cold water to a more, a fuller term of just welcoming you.
Mm-hmm. There's also another way to look at it in Matthew's gospel, which is there are two quotations from Hosea where Matthew has Jesus repeat twice, once in Matthew 9:13, right before the sending of the disciples out to sort of practice ministry in the course of learning discipleship. Matthew 9:13, "Go and learn what this means," says Jesus, quoting Hosea, "I desire mercy, not sacrifice." And then, close quote, and then Jesus continues, "For I have come to call not the righteous, but sinners." And then Matthew 12:7, the same quote from Hosea, I think it's Hosea 6:6. Jesus says at in the middle of chapter 12, "But if you had known what this means, I desire mercy and not sacrifice, you would not have condemned the guiltless." We'd have to dig more into the context of chapter 12. But we're in the middle, if we regard those two things as bookends, we're in the middle of that section in which there's an injunction by Jesus to disciples and listeners to really work out what it means, what Hosea means. "I desire mercy, not sacrifice." So we could look at our section of chapter 10 in the light of those two quotations as well, and that's sort of what I'd like to do.
Mm-hmm. And it would dovetail really nicely with the Genesis 22. Or to at least think through what's going on there, in some ways, to speak of, you know, mercy, not sacrifice. Mm-hmm. I would like to hear what you think Jesus means when he says mercy rather than sacrifice, as in some ways those would be, it seems obvious what juxtaposing them means, but then when you think about it, they're not necessarily opposites, right? It would be possible to make a sacrifice and to be merciful. So what exactly is going on here, and what is it that Jesus would be saying here, to which this, because if I understood you correctly, you're saying this would be an example of what Jesus means by mercy rather than sacrifice, right?
Not going to be able to summarize everything, but just one angle on it would be the context for the first utterance is table fellowship, commensality of meals together with tax collectors and sinners. They're all sitting with the disciples, and the Pharisees say to the disciples of Jesus, "Why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners?" So Jesus says, "Those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick, do go and learn what this means. I desire mercy, not sacrifice, for I've come not to call the righteous, but sinners. So it's kind of, it's asking questions about the, I would say, Josh, about the meaning of community, the boundaries of community life.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one of the hallmarks of Jesus in the Gospels is this boundlessness of table fellowship, where people want to set limits on it. Jesus seems to want to expand it. He doesn't view this as antinomian. I don't think in Matthew that's the right reading.
Mm-hmm.
It's not against the law, but it's characteristic of the realm of God. That's what the realm of God, and that's what the inbreaking realm of God is being acted out during the course of the ministry looks like. I mean, it's no accident that in chapter 10, after opening up this whole teaching, we get the dispatch of the disciples. So they have this stuff in mind. Now, it's a really odd thing, I must confess, that in chapter 10, verse 5, Jesus puts some boundaries out there on where they go. Go nowhere among the Gentiles and enter no town of the Samaritans, but go rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Okay, so, you know, so we're dealing with certain marginal constituencies, but not people outside how he demarcates boundaries and so on. So it may be, Josh, that Matthew's Jesus is also part of the learning process about redefining mercy, opening up mercy. Because in 15, chapter 15, with the Canaanite woman, he's going to be outside the boundaries of Israel. There he is in the seaside region.
Mm-hmm.
So in that context, with that dialogue, with that person, that woman outside the boundary of Israel, in chapter 15, by the time 15 comes about, the boundaries are being redefined for him, not just in his language, but maybe Matthew is setting out a narrative pattern that somehow itself widens boundaries, so that Jesus himself is included in that widening. That would be a start to your helpful question.
It is interesting to consider that in the light of the whole of Hebrew scripture, because of the way that, you know, that whole section of running from Deuteronomy through 2 Kings, that's oftentimes, you know, the Deuteronomist history, right, which is all about the law is life and opposition to the law is death, you know, choose which way you're going to go,
right,
and make sure that you don't have any interaction with, you know, those that are not following the law, right, unless they
right.
submit to following the law, to circumcision and following the law. So Canaanites and the other surrounding peoples. And so there's a, yeah, what I hear and what you're saying is that in one respect, you can read Jesus when he sends out the disciples as saying, you know, as within that frame of reference. But then we see within Matthew itself this movement of where those boundaries start to become fluid. Jesus interacting with a Canaanite woman and the priority of mercy as opposed to that the law itself is
yes.
is prioritizing mercy as yes. opposed to I don't know what we would it's in this context it would be sacrifice but it, I don't know exactly what it is. It's not because it's not about as you said, it's not against the law, so it's not just illegal but it's also it's not just like ignoring the law either. There's something about what it means to be faithful to Torah.
Mm-hmm.
To be merciful.
Yes.
And that would connect as well with the psalm that, you know, your steadfast love. So there's something about steadfast love, mercy. Anyway.
Yes. Yes, because mercy is something that balances justice. So the other aspect of Hesed is the suspension of justice in favor of mercy. And that's what God is modeling. in the histories of which you're speaking.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the psalm is trying to laud, praise in Psalm 80.
Is there a connection linguistically between hesed and mercy?
Yes.
Or are they different ideas?
Okay. Well, hesed is rendered by mercy in the Septuagint.
Mm-hmm.
Hesed in Psalm 89, 1 and 2 is rendered by mercy in the Greek translation of the Hebrew scriptures. So that's what I'm building on.
So Jesus here, and because the Septuagint is really the scriptures mostly for the writers of the New Testament.
Yes.
Jesus would be say we could say here Jesus is saying or in that context, I desire hesed
yes.
rather than sacrifice.
Yes. Yes.
An aspect of it that I've been thinking about while you've both unpacked this material connects to the book ends that you pointed out, Deirdre. And in my imagination, the way I imagine how the words are in relation to each other or passages are in relation to each other in the bookended material, there are two things that come to mind that I just add into what you've been saying, is that there is a kind of tension in the section itself between thanksgiving and challenge, between blessing and woe, between travails and rewards, told in different narratives. But when I pick up so I'm noting that, mm-hmm. and there's something I want to come back to that's an interesting relationship within the Matthean piece. But at first I had difficulty seeing the connection of all these passages. But as you articulated hesed, and as you talked about the antinomianism, that's not there. I expanded it a little bit to think about the relationship between Matthew and the tradition of history, of God's work in Israel, of temple, the whole life of Israel through history.
Mm-hmm.
How hesed and sacrifice and actually a pronominalism that is there connects to, say, the Genesis 22 chapter, where sacrifice is present, mm-hmm. but there's as an intention, but it's not fulfilled, something that could be called mercy or release is the end of the story.
Mm-hmm.
So the tension between sacrifice and some form or expression of mercy seems to be present in the lectionary readings across the board. But then, interestingly, looking at Matthew 10, where especially from verse 34 through to 36 or 39 even, you know, do not think that I have come to bring peace to the earth. I have not come to bring peace, but a sword. And the harshness of setting a man against his father, a daughter against her mother, and so on and so forth, and the challenge that you cannot love these people any more mm-hmm. than you love me.
Mm-hmm.
I have to be paramount. That sets up for very deep conflict. But then when, in a way I never thought about before, when you move then to whoever welcomes you welcomes me, in some kind of way it expands it into the possibilities for the Canaanite woman to be included, but also include the possibilities that the family can be restored inside of this grand welcome, mm-hmm. but certainly moving beyond a particular image of family. So the whosoever welcomes. So inside hesed, sacrifice, there's this sacrifice, but welcome conflict, but welcome, and how they play out again with each other, not against each other, but with each other, could be part of the larger thematic of the section that you identified.
Fabulous. Very helpful.
Yeah, and I'm just, you know, I think all that we've been talking about, it's how they intersect to make various kinds of subpoints within this very rich narrative.
And there may be a way to read what's going on with Abraham in Genesis 22 along these same lines, in the sense that, and Althea, I think you made a gesture in that direction in your comment, but it's often framed as, you know, God commanded, and again we think of like, you know, the commandments of the law here. God commanded Abraham to do this, and Abraham was willing to do it, and because Abraham was willing to do it, then, you know, God relented, and but I have, over the last few years when I've contemplated this, I've started to think about, like, maybe the story, the focus of the story is not so much on God's commandment as on Abraham himself, in the sense of, like, I've imagined Abraham in this situation going, you know, being ready and prepared to do this because this is what the expectation was, right? And there's some indication that the sacrifice of a firstborn was something that Israelites or some other surrounding cultures practiced, right? Passing through the fire, Molech, and this kind of stuff. But Abraham, you know, doing his duty, right? Obeying what the expectation is, mm-hmm. nonetheless, at the moment of about to do it, says, no, I'm not going to do that. mm-hmm. And that's the act of faith, in mm-hmm. a sense, right? Mm-hmm. To suspend. And in suspending what the expectation is, what he believes his obedience is meant to be, he nonetheless exercises mercy. And that itself is the act of faith, which God praises, or to discern the difference between an idol of his own making, of his own people, and the what is truly the will of God, or something along those lines. Maybe we could read it that way. I've found it myself illuminating.
Yeah, I mean, what would be the notion of justice if Abraham had sacrificed Isaac? Mm-hmm. I mean, what would be left of his relationship with God? Mm-hmm. I mean, this way, the exercise, the obedience of those opening lines, he says to him, Abraham. And he said, here I am. And he said, take your son, your only son, Isaac. I mean, all these descriptors about the limits, the endlessness of obedience is met by the end of the narrative in the sense that there is a meaning to obedience. And part of the manifestation of obedience is what we do with that obedience. How do we actually treat other people? How does it say something about our relationship to God, so that both the relationship to God and to the promise of God, the reality of the flesh and blood of the promise of God, is intact? Mm-hmm. Now, the person who suffers is Sarah.
Yes. And maybe, you know, maybe Isaac had a little problem too.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah. You know, it's such a powerful memory. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And an interesting one. You know, I think our psychology today, our mentalities today might look at this God and see in the Akedah and think of this God as rather provocative, maybe testing. I mean, who sets up such a cruel-looking mm-hmm. action mm-hmm. and then pulls you along and at the last minute says, oh, I was just joking. Mm-hmm. I really mm-hmm. mean for you to do mm-hmm. all of this. Yet this is a critical part of Israel's memory. Mm-hmm. You know, whether it speaks about how they understood God as testing them, as relating to historical hardships, difficulties, and challenges that they might have gone through, to lay this at God's feet, in God's hands, and to be able to say with a narrative like this, even when we are discomfited and set upon, which is something we recognized a few weeks ago, God still comes through with a thing that relieves us, that redeems us. Mm-hmm. And does that help us to understand how Jesus can juxtapose mercy and sacrifice, mm-hmm. and move Israel, whose law he has not come to abolish but to fulfill, move it towards a better insight into their relationship with Yahweh, better insight into their understanding of Yahweh, that what has been implicit can be explicitly stated, even in this time when things aren't always hunky-dory. That of this new community that is interpreting Israel in a particular kind of way, what is preeminent is mercy and not sacrifice. Mm-hmm. So building upon a tradition that's implicit there in the Akedah.
Very helpful, very helpful.
As Christians, we've tried to find a compass in our time, a mm-hmm. compass by which to do things such as, and I hope I'm not mistiming this when I say it, but this morning as we are preparing to record, we hear that the Supreme Court has decided that DACA cannot be canceled because of procedural missteps by the Trump administration.
Right.
What is a compass by which we decide as Christians to stand with DACA recipients, mm-hmm. to mm-hmm. stand with those who have been ostracized, demonized, stigmatized by the dominant groups of our society? Mm-hmm. How do we understand mercy and sacrifice? You know, how do we live them out and have them articulated in our ethical choices?
So glad you mentioned that piece of contemporary news.
Yeah,
I was just going to say. I mean, it when you think of, I mean, the narrative presents it very clearly as Abraham. It's Abraham's willingness to do this that mm-hmm. is the key. Mm-hmm. But when we later, if we interpret this in the light of you know, the way, the gloss that Paul puts on it, right? It's his faith or his faithfulness. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, well, mm-hmm. And there's a way to look at this narrative where it's well, what does that mean exactly, right? What does obedience to the commandment mean? And that this is the moment where that's crystallized, where mm-hmm. especially if you look at it as like obedience leads to life and death and disobedience leads to death, right? Mm-hmm. Well, sacrificing Isaac is very clearly the path of death mm-hmm. in all of this rather than the path of life. And so mm-hmm. if you could look at it as this crucible of discernment that Abraham has, where he realizes, I may be commanded to do this, or I may understand what obedience means as this, but this very clearly is not the way. And then Jesus coming along later and saying it's about, you know, obedience really is steadfast love. Mm-hmm. It's mercy. That this raises this question about this would not be antinomian or against the law at all, but it would be the way in which the law itself is fulfilled. And when we talk about you know, well, the law, I mean, and then just to take it out of that context and to put it in the raising the questions that Althea was mentioning about now, where should our boundaries be in terms of who we are? We have to enforce those boundaries. We have to, you know, this kind of idea, but what is it that's going to guide our judgments, our ethical judgments, our political judgments in terms of how we manage this? Will it be mercy, steadfast love, or will it be sacrifice in the sense of like what we understand obedience to be and the application of the letter of the law. I don't know. I don't like that term letter of the law, but you see the contrast mm-hmm. that I'm drawing, right? Mm-hmm. Or mm-hmm. maybe the way police officers treat the people that they encounter, right? I mean, mm-hmm. they're there to enforce the law, but this may raise a question. What exactly does that mean? Mm-hmm. What is the purpose? What's the purpose of policing? What's the purpose of the acts of that we use to ensure protection and safety? Mm-hmm. And what does that really mean? And at what point do you become an agent of where you're no longer protecting but destroying? Mm-hmm. Right? And so, mm-hmm. yeah. Anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And yeah. Yeah, and post the flood, where God has given the promise implicit in this rainbow, you know, the police arguably have gone where, based on the Genesis 22 story, the police in these narratives that dominate our news outlets now, mm-hmm. the police have gone where God stepped back from.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I am thinking rather complicatedly of Abram's a kind of a fatalistic approach. I'm going to put that beside obedience, a fatalistic approach to God's will, which I can see echoed in even more ancient narratives, say in narratives like the Homeric stories,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
the Iliad and the Odyssey, a kind of understanding of the supreme potency of deities, that human beings are just absolutely subject to their will. So you mm-hmm. might well either appease or comply.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that is present in Abram. And as we read these stories and bring them into the present, to what extent do we participate in that kind of fatalism where God's or consciousness of any principles of life that we believe have been given to us by God must be absolutely obeyed, but yet without the courage of an Abraham or the freedom to understand that there is a line that God will not pass. Even in omnipotence, there's a line that God will not pass where righteousness moves over into the realm of abject cruelty.
I'm so glad you said this. There's a great scene, as you all know, I'm sure, in the Iliad, where in book three, Hector is sent by the gods to take Priam into the Greek camp. Priam is the Trojan king. And Priam, in the Trojan camp, in the middle of the night, gets into Achilles' tent and mm-hmm. pleads with Achilles to take pity, to have mercy on a father, that's him, bereft of his son, and return Hector's body. Remember, Achilles has killed Hector and dragged his body by the heel in desecration around the walls of Troy. And what Priam does there is evoke the memory of Achilles' own father, Peleus. Mm-hmm. And this plea for mercy of one suppliant man to another, which is so not the theme of the Iliad, mm-hmm. stands out in high contrast, because Priam says to Achilles, "Pity me, I have endured what no one on earth has ever done before. I have put my lips to the hands of the man who killed my son."
Mm-hmm.
And that gesture and that plea makes Achilles relent, and he returns Hector's corpse to the Trojans, to Priam, to the grieving father, and so on.
Yeah.
So it's the exception that we want to highlight now, in a violent narrative where war is paramount. And so I'm so glad mm-hmm. you made me think of that little moment, and what we're doing hundreds of years after the Iliad and the narrative of the Iliad, what we're doing is saying we're highlighting the recognition of loss and sacrifice and murder as it's transmitted in these ancient narratives, whether from the Hebrew Bible or the Greek or Greek history.
And thank you so much for bringing that, because Achilles recognizes in that act something far more courageous yep. than even he has exercised, which is what he prizes. It's the excellence that he wants to put on display, yes. and his own rage,
yes,
which is driven as the theme of the
yes,
poem.
Yes, rage is the theme. Yes,
and then in this moment he sees. Like this is the true, you know, like, you know, I'm the warrior that removed myself from the thing, from the war in order to bring this whole thing down. And here is this man who's done something that far exceeds my own courage. Yes,
exactly.
And he sees a common humanity in him. And that's really remarkable.
It's something that so few people highlight in reading, but you knew it, Josh. It's such a rare moment. But if you're keyed into compassion and mercy, you know, it mm-hmm. just it's just spotlight. It's the spotlight mm-hmm. of the whole thing. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. And doesn't that all enter into our current conversations and choices? It seems like Jesus has hit on something perpetual.
Yes.
Mercy, yes. sacrifice. And when you both highlight that mercy is actually in the minority position,
yes.
the valued position, what understandings are we getting about the struggles of our time
exactly.
to really pinpoint, highlight, and value mercy, compassion, care over hostility, conflict, and the will to make somebody else be your scapegoat, somebody else be your sacrifice.
Yep.
It's feeling right in this moment as if we are in a very, very old conversation among mm-hmm. you. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I know we're not in that in this season, but then, you know, if Jesus, I'm so glad you pointed this out, Deirdre, if Jesus is pitting mercy and sacrifice for our consideration, we might say he was the ultimate sacrifice mm-hmm. by his death. Mm-hmm. But look at us today,
yep.
having a conversation about texts that are over 2,000 years old, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. events. Does mercy not give us the seed of victory?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I'm so glad that we've been able to touch on these relevant and timeless issues, even as we are struggling nationally to address them in our time. And we're struggling at a terrible, terrible cost. It's just there are bodies everywhere. It's almost unfathomable. So it's just so horrible to have to live through this. And I'm, you know, not even in the middle of it at all.
I'm just thinking we keep remembering. Mm-hmm. We have to keep remembering.
Right.
The things we have pointed out, the importance of mercy. That's my prejudice, but I really think we need to remember mercy. Yes.
Well, let's make that. That's the last word, Althea. Let's make that our last word. And let's try to fortify ourselves with our discussion, which we'll be able to listen to again. And we hope that this has been of some help for not just for ourselves, but for other people too. And I thank you both immensely for your input into this too. And I'm so grateful for our trialogue. And I look forward to the next occasion. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Goodbye. Till next time, everybody. Bye-bye.